Good morning, everybody. This sounds loud to me. Is it too loud up there? About right?
Sounds good.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Our speaker today is Neil Mann, and this is my first day of getting to meet Neil in person, but I've talked to him over the phone several times. He's a great guy. I really like him. He's a fabulous guy. He has a very interesting background. Neil is an electrical engineer. He designs circuit boards and other electronic devices during the day. But what's most fascinating about him is what he does at night. He is a lay preacher and a Christian apologist at night. He has a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer and electrical engineering, and a master's in solid-state physics and computer engineering with a minor in mathematics. So he's obviously somebody who can keep our audiovisual equipment going in the church. Neil is also an entrepreneur. He's founded four startup companies in the Bay Area and two companies internationally. Some of the companies that he founded actually survived the dot-com bomb time, but unfortunately, he says he can't retire just yet. Neil is a pretty creative guy. He has over 20 issued and pending patents in areas ranging from networking and packet processing to highway alert systems, a pretty broad and diverse area. In his free time, Neil travels and speaks around the United States teaching a rational defense of the Christian faith. He was referred to us and recommended very, very highly by the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. And Neil actually has brought some material for us. There's on the table right next to the door from the Family Research Council. And I think you'll find some of the materials quite interesting. Neil is the father, brand new father, of his words, and I think he's correct, the most beautiful baby girl in the world, born 4 days ago on Tuesday morning, and the husband of the loveliest woman in the world. And man is not even here. And he said that voluntarily. And he's correct. In fact, as an aside, I have to tell you, when we were lining Neil up to speak, we came up with a date. And then we asked him if he'd speak and said yes. He said, there's one small problem. What's that? My wife is pregnant. The baby is due, right around the time of the speech. I said, oh gosh, how are we going to do this? And so he said, well, let me talk to her and see what she said. And he called back and he said, she said that he can do it as long as if she hasn't delivered the night before the event, we have a backup speaker. I mean, that is kind of so, in any event, Neil, his wife Anna, and their new daughter, Mary Catherine, live in San Jose. And Neil is currently working on two books, Gödel, Einstein, and Darwin, How Four-Dimensional Questions Cannot Be Answered by Four-Dimensional Answers, and Jesus and Caesar, Should Christians Be Involved in Politics? So please join me in a warm hillside welcome for Neil Mann.
Okay, I have to start with a picture of my daughter. That's her on the phone. Modern technology. Okay. We have filled every place amongst you. Cities, islands, fortresses, towns, marketplaces, the very camp, tribes, companies, palace, senate, forum. We have left nothing to you but the temples of your gods. This is a quote by Tertullian. In case you're wondering who Tertullian was, he was a Christian lawyer and apologist, and this was a letter to the Romans in the second century. You see, Tertullian was mocking the Romans who thought that they could defeat Christianity by oppressing it and retreating to their temples and shoring up their religious life. We all know what happened to Rome. I was born in Ghana. And I know some of you are thinking that this is a town in Texas. It's actually a country in the west coast of Africa. My parents are Indian, and I grew up in Jamaica, Ethiopia, India, Yemen, and Sudan. Yes, yes, I know you're thinking that Sudan is a town in Texas. It is. Just off Highway 85, take a left on the Dairy Queen, and there it is, right? But that's not the Sudan I grew up. The Sudan I grew up is the country in Africa. It's an Arabic-speaking country, and I spent most of my youth there. And I used to speak Arabic. Unfortunately, I forgot most of my Arabic once I came to the States and started watching Star Trek in English. But, that's the side effect you have. Now, I am Indian by ancestry, and you think I would know about one of the 300 languages in India, but the best I can do, the closest I can get to, is how I can be able to be talking a very good Indian accent. And if I ever don't get a job, I can get a job at 7-Eleven, so I know I'm safe there. Now, you're probably wondering how I came to have traveled so much. It wasn't that I was a renowned jet-setting toddler. It was just that my dad is a professor in physics, and he would travel and teach at universities all over the world, so I got to go along with the ride. Now, to clarify my faith to you, our family hails back to St. Thomas in AD 52 when he came to India and he started a church back there. So that's the background of the history. My dad recently told me that we've always had a lay preacher in our family. So I'm keeping that tradition. I said, why didn't you tell me that before? He said, well, I didn't want to put any pressure on you. So, and I give you all this background to give you a brief story of my first attempt to come to the United States. Years ago, my dad was a professor in physics in Yemen, which is right off the Arabian Peninsula, right below Saudi Arabia. And he had been working there for 6 years as a professor of physics at the Sana'a University. He didn't plan to keep working there. I was about 18 years old, and for the most of those 18 years, I had dreamt about coming to the U.S. to go to college. I mean, the U.S. was the land of my destiny. It was the land of my dreams. It was the land of my heart. It was the land of some very, very beautiful women. At least, that's what I could, you know, that's what I saw on TV, on the movies. But a professor's pay in Yemen was not at that time a very good, was not sufficient, really, to pay college tuition in the U.S. And it's even less so now. However, my parents talked about it for a while, and they decided that they should dig into their savings and send me here. And I did a lot of research, and I found this really small college in Eastern Oregon that we could actually afford. So, but it was conditional, of course, on my dad keeping his job in Yemen. But we saw no reason why that should not happen. I remember that afternoon when my dad came home from work. It was about 2 months before I was supposed to leave. He came in, he sat us all down, and he told us that the contract that he had with the government of Yemen and the university had been terminated. You see, we found out that a fellow professor had committed suicide. And when they went into the professor's, when the police went into the professor's house, they found a Bible on his bedside, and it had my father's name in it. Now, my dad was well known, and he had a lot of connections, political connections as well, being a professor, everybody respects you, and that's why they didn't throw him in prison. But in effect, my dad was saying that because a fellow worker had a Bible from him, we had to leave the country, and my dreams were shattered. Why? Because it is illegal to give someone who is not a Christian a Bible in Yemen. Does anyone here know why? I mean, I'm sure most of you do know why, after spending 40 years in the wilderness and 800 years building up the nation of Israel and 50 years building up Solomon's kingdom to this mighty empire that everybody knows everywhere, all over Africa and Asia, God allows and sends in the Assyrians to crush and destroy Israel, and later he sends the Babylonians to destroy the nation of Judea and burn it to the ground. In fact, they destroyed so effectively that the very Ark of the Covenant disappears forever, and the gold in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, the fire in the Holy of Holies gets so hot that the gold melts into the very ground. In fact, the terribleness of the sieges against God's people can be understood by this passage. 2 Kings 6, as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried to him, "Help me, my lord, the king." He asked her, "What's the matter?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give up your son so that we may eat him today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son.'" And what's her complaint? Her complaint is, "So we cooked my son and ate him. The next day I said to her, 'Give up your son so that we may eat him,' but she had hidden him." There are numerous passages like this in the Old Testament. But why was this happening? Why are these the children of God? Why are they God's chosen people? Why did God abandon them like this? Why did God let them to be so horribly tortured and destroyed and then taken from their families into exile? Why? You remember why, right? What were they doing just before the destruction of the temple? What was happening to the people of Israel? What was happening to Judea? They were what? Abandoning who? They were abandoning God, right? This happened because they turned away from him. Because they abandoned his principles and they did not fear him anymore. But it wasn't just the children and the people of Israel and Judea who abandoned God. It was who else? Their kings. It was their kings whom they followed. It was the kings whom they copied. It was the kings whom they influenced them. It was the kings who led them astray. It was their kings who first disobeyed God. In other words, God punished the people because of who? Their leaders. This is even more interesting in the fact that they didn't get to elect their kings. Now the question is, if people who don't get to elect their leaders get judged because of the actions of their leaders, how much more do we as a nation deserve to be judged who do get to elect our leaders? Now let me ask you this. During the sieges and the attacks, God obviously saved a few good people. Like, remember the widow and Elisha, you know, the food and all that stuff. But here's the question. Did all the innocent people, that is, all those who still love God, did they all get spared? Well, we'd like to think so. But the Bible never says so, right? What happened? We know that the good were taken into exile just like the bad. Good people, in some cases, castrated into eunuchs like the bad. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, Daniel. Good women raped just like the bad. Babies smashed and, as you saw, cooked and eaten. Are you telling me that those babies disobeyed God? Of course they didn't. The good suffered along with the bad. The good experienced the terrible, terrible judgment of God just like the bad. The good were raped and beaten and kidnapped and orphaned and killed just like the bad. And God didn't judge his own people only. He also judged who else? He judged all the heathen nations, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and everybody else. He judges everybody. My point? My point is that God judges all nations. And when God judges a nation because of the leaders or because of the people in the nation, you and I, the followers of Christ, and our innocent children will suffer the physical consequences. Let me say that once more because it's so important. When God judges a nation, when God judges our nation because of our leaders, you and I, the followers of Christ, and our children will also suffer the physical consequences of that judgment. Let me ask you this. Do you think that our great nation deserves to be judged for our practices today? Do you think that some of the things that we do violate God's law and are just as deserving of judgment as the ancient nations of Babylon and Israel? I would think so, wouldn't you? We have to change our nation. We have to change, though, not from the bottom up, but also in the leadership, in the culture, in the marketplaces, in the arts, in the Senate, in the forum. But here's the thing, we have to be involved in its leadership to change its leadership, don't we? We have to be involved in its laws to change its laws. We have to be involved in its culture to change its culture. Because if not, we're doomed either way, physically, when God sends his judgment. You know, a long time ago, we saw adultery promoted on TV. This started to change the culture and the hearts and the mind of the people, who then started to change the laws. And then the gay lifestyle was promoted on TV. This resulted eventually in the repeal of the sodomy laws, and now gay marriage is being forced upon us. Add to that no-fault divorce, broken families, abortion, mercy killing, euthanasia, recently the killing of a mentally retarded woman by dehydrating her to death. What's next? Homosexuality being taught as an acceptable alternative to third graders? It's already happening. People suing for polygamous marriages? It's already happening. You see, little things lead to big things. Just last year, one of the most liberal papers in the company published this column. We don't need to read through it. I'll just give you the highlights. And basically, it says that a change in the law of contraceptives in the 70s led to a new concept of privacy, which led to abortion and a repeal of the sodomy laws, and now to gay marriage. There is a slippery slope, and we are on it. Little laws lead to other laws, because most laws are based on precedents. Some Christians think we should not be involved in politics. But if you think about that, that happens. We get what happened in Washington, D.C. A Christian organization in Washington, D.C. was told to remove their own Ten Commandments monument on their own land just because it faced a public square. In 2005, the county of Los Angeles decided to replace the seal and removed a cross and a saint and replaced them with a Native American princess. And there were no Christians at the county meeting to object. They were all too busy. See, if we don't get involved in politics, then what happens will happen to us what happened to Canada, England, and Sweden. Pastors are being arrested for preaching from passages in the Bible that just say homosexuality is a sin. They don't need to say it, they just need to read the verse. Soon it'll be a crime just to infer that we are all sinners because it'll hurt our self-esteem, right? So I asked pastors and Christians, and I've talked to pastors about this. I had a pastor say, well, I don't think we should be involved in politics. It's not the place for us to be involved in politics. We should be involved in preaching. And I said, well, what are you going to do when you preach and they throw you in prison and nobody's going to come bail you out because everybody, you yourself have encouraged people not to be involved in the very politics that may create the laws that put you in prison. I think we have to turn the tide around, lest God visit the wrath He visited on the nations of Judea, on you, your parents, and your siblings. We must turn back to God, but how do we turn the tide? We can't just stay in our churches and hide. Remember the Romans? Staying in their temples didn't work for them, did it? Why do you think it'll work for us? Do we just preach the gospel to anyone who will listen and hope that God will just use that, and hope He just ignores that our leaders and culture is corrupt? It didn't work in the Old Testament, it didn't work in the New Testament, and then I'll show you Jesus didn't do that. I'm going to show you in a few minutes how Jesus didn't just preach the gospel, but got involved very actively. But how do we change the direction of our nation? Well, it's simple. In a democratic society, by the way, we are a republic, not a democracy, and I'll tell you why later in the question and answer session, why that's important. In a democratic society, we use politics and we use culture and we use ministry and evangelization to change the nation, right? Today I'm here to talk about the politics part of it. But we can't forget the culture part. The culture is very important. And I think the church effectively has the other two parts, which is evangelization and ministry. We have that, really effectively. But I've talked to a lot of Christians who don't understand how important it is to get involved in politics. One guy I talked to said this. He said, well, I think all these politicians are corrupt. So we should just stay out of it completely. Now, I don't think it occurred to him that the solution for corrupt politicians is what? Godly men and women involved in politics, right? Now, but you can't have godly politicians unless they run. And you can't have godly politicians who are running win unless people get behind them and help them win. It's not enough to vote, you've got to help them win. Some friends I was talking to said this. He said, I don't think we're called to get involved in all that worldly stuff. Besides, you can't legislate morality because laws don't change hearts. Now, the three logical and factual flaws in the statement, and I'm going to walk you through them systematically in just a bit. But first of all, before I do that, I want to look in the manual, that's the Bible, and see if it gives us any examples of whether we should be involved in politics. Okay, so let's look at Joseph in the Old Testament. You guys remember Joseph, right? Joseph goes up to Pharaoh. Pharaoh tells him, Joseph, I'm going to make you the chief politician. Joseph says, no, Pharaoh, that's a terrible thing. Politics is corrupt. I don't want to have anything to do with it. No, he doesn't. What does he do? He becomes the chief politician and he changes the culture. Right? And now, 400 years later, what happens to his descendants? You know, the Bible says they did not know Pharaoh, which meant they didn't stay involved in politics. And what happens to them? They become slaves. Okay, look at Nehemiah. He's a politician. He's getting involved with politics. Look at Daniel. Not only does Daniel become involved in politics, but he does what? He does civil disobedience. Public civil disobedience. And then he gets involved in the culture and he changes the laws and he changes their culture and he changes their habits. The Bible is full of examples of people being involved in politics. Not only the politics of their country, but also politics of their adopted country. This is especially good for me because I am an immigrant. This is my adopted country. And I have some great biblical role models as to why I should personally be involved politically. The great example to me, of course, is Esther. Now, you remember the story of Esther, right? Esther is a slave girl living in Persia. She's Jewish. Nobody knows that. And through a sequence of events, she, because of her great beauty, becomes the wife to the king. The wife. I always used to think it was a harem, but no, she was the wife to the king. And while she's the king's wife, a plot unfolds to kill and execute every single one of the Jews. Remember that, right? Her uncle Mordecai goes to her and he asks for help. And her first answer is basically this. Her first answer is, it's not permitted for me to go to the king of my own accord. I mean, if I approach the king on my own, I could be put to death. Can we read more into her answer? I like to think this is what she really said. She said, is it really my place to get involved? It's so dangerous. It's so costly. It's so worldly. I don't think there's much I can do. I mean, after all, I don't think we shouldn't be involved this way. After all, God is in control. He'll decide what the king does and doesn't do. He will choose the leaders. It's up to God to decide. This is somebody else's job. Besides, our nation will grow under persecution. Besides, you can see the king is surrounded by those crooked politicians. And even if we pass a law to save the Jews, laws don't change hearts, and you can't legislate morality. Is that your attitude today? Is that how we feel about politics today? What does her uncle Mordecai say to her? He says in Esther 4:13, he says, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this." He was saying, what if this was the reason that God made you so beautiful? What if this was the reason that He chose you to be queen? What if this was why God put you here? What if this was the one reason why you were created? And her answer, knowing that by approaching the king of her own accord, she could be put to death, she says this. She says, "Then I will do it. And if I perish, I perish." Then what does Esther do? She makes an appeal to the king. She creates a political action committee of one. And now you have to read this carefully, because she doesn't just go up to the king and says, "Oh, there's a plot." No, because she understands politics. She says, she has a big party and she has a big shindig, and she invites the very person who's trying to kill her. She has, plays all these little smart games. And finally, she saves the entire nation of Jews in exile. Because she figures out the way to get her point across. Let's look at the Old Testament. The Old Testament, look at the prophets in the Old Testament. You know one prophet who didn't get involved in politics? You know one prophet who didn't go up to the king and say, "Hey, you're doing the wrong thing, you shouldn't be doing this"? Every one of them was talking to the king. And some of them got their heads chopped off for that. Even John the Baptist in the New Testament. What's he doing? He's going up to Herod and he's saying, "This is wrong." He's speaking out against moral injustice. Speaking out against morality. Okay, I was teaching this class once in a college group, and a young, sweet girl raised her hand. She said, "Yeah, but Jesus didn't get involved in politics. He didn't try to change the laws of Rome. He said, 'Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God.' You have to separate the two. So if Jesus didn't do it, we shouldn't." Well, there are a few problems with this. First of all, just because Jesus didn't do it does not mean we should not do it. Jesus never fought against slavery or racism. Does that mean we should not? Not a good example. Secondly, the idea that Jesus did not get involved in politics is just merely a misunderstanding of history. Let me ask you a question. Let's look at Jesus and the politics of Rome. Imagine today that we had an Iraqi citizen. An Iraqi citizen comes to the United States. He's not a U.S. citizen. He's an Iraqi citizen who comes to the United States. And he says, he goes to the senator, goes to the president, he says, "We need to change the laws in America to allow four wives, just like in Iraq." How effective will he be? Zero. Why? He's not a what citizen? He's not a U.S. citizen. Oh, so you have to be a citizen of the country if the laws are going to change, right? Oh, very interesting point. So what was Jesus? Was Jesus a Roman citizen? No. He was what? A Jewish citizen. So which laws is he going to apply to? The Jewish laws or the Roman laws? The Jewish laws, obviously. Now, we do know of a Christian Roman citizen. Who was that? Paul. Did he get involved in the laws and appealing to the legal authorities in Rome? Obviously he did. In fact, he went right up to Caesar, right? So let's go back to Jesus. Jesus was a Jewish citizen. So who were Jesus' senators and representatives? Pharisees. Why? They were the members of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin means sitting together, hence assembly, is a name given to the council of 71 Jewish sages who constituted who? The Supreme Court and who? The legislative, read, lawmaking body of ancient Israel. The makeup of the council included a chief justice, a vice chief justice, and 69 general members who sat in the form of a semicircle when in session. And who were the members of the Sanhedrin? Who were Jesus' senators? Who were his representatives? The Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now you tell me that Jesus was not talking to them on a daily basis. Now you tell me he wasn't telling them that the laws were wrong, they were interpreting it wrong. You tell me he wasn't in their faces on a regular basis. You tell me Jesus was not involved in politics. half his message were to the politicians and the lawmakers, his own lawmakers. Jesus was so involved in politics, and he sets an example for all of us. I get carried away. I'm not yelling at you guys. I get so passionate about this because this is exactly what we need to do. Now look, let's take it a step further. Look, who were the followers of Jesus who were the lawmakers? Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus. We don't see any indication that Jesus says, once you're a Christian, leave. In fact, we know that Joseph was still in the Sanhedrin because he uses his influence to try and get Jesus' body from Pilate. So he goes one nation to another nation. See, getting involved in the lawmaking process and civil disobedience. Remember when Jesus heals on the Sabbath? Civil disobedience. Saying you've got the laws all wrong. You're interpreting it wrong. It's a sign to the judges, if you will. It's modeled to us in the New Testament. Remember, why stop with Jesus? That's enough. But let's look at Christians and other Christians. William Wilberforce. How many people who know this, who this guy is? Okay, let me tell you about this guy. This is a guy you need to know who he is, because he is such an important person. William Wilberforce was a religious Christian man, and they're coming out with a movie called Amazing Grace, by the way, which is his story. You should definitely watch it. He worked for 20 years in the British Parliament to abolish slavery. 20 years. And he finally does so. Now, do you think this was after the slaves were freed in America or before? Before. You know how many years before? Almost 80 years before. He spends 20 years trying to change the law, and it takes him that long, and the movie shows how many times he almost gave up. And he manages to change the entire, they ban slavery in England, and now the English armada, the vast armada of ships that used to go out into all the world capturing slaves, now goes all out into the world and stops slave trading by attacking slave ships and freeing the slaves. Now let's ask him, oh, by the way, this movement comes to the United States and coalesces as the Free Earth Society, and coalesces under the new reformed Republican Party with who as their leader? Abraham Lincoln. And then we had the Civil War and the freedom of emancipation. Now imagine, if you will, if Wilberforce said, you know what, this is not politics. I'm not supposed to be involved in politics. I'm supposed to stay home and preach. Or I'm supposed to stay home and vote. What would have happened? It would have affected not only Britain, but it would have affected the United States. Now let's look at the rest of change in the country. The abolition of slavery is brought about by religious people like the Quakers, who realized that slavery was against the law. But whose law was slavery against? Man's law? God's law. Because it was the law to have slaves, it was against God's law. Exactly. Now, but they were joined by not only black ministers, but the civil rights movement, also started by religious people, by black ministers, and joined by thousands of white preachers and pastors and churchgoers initially, and then that's when it started taking off. So basically, if abortion is going to be stopped, who's going to stop it? Religious people, Christians. If the cloning of humans for spare parts is going to be stopped, who's going to stop it? Christians and religious people. If gay marriage is going to be stopped, who's going to stop it? Christians and religious people. I say religious people because I have some Muslim friends who are just against gay marriage as we are. So who's going to stop this? Who's going to change the country? You and me, Christians and religious people. If there's change coming, we have to bring it about. Now, some people have said to this, and I'm going to give you a quick lesson in logical refutation. It's wrong to impose your moral values on others. You can't legislate morality, and laws can't change hearts. Okay, I want to teach you, I want to take a quick digression here, and I want to teach you one of my favorite topics to teach. I teach apologetics, and I travel to different churches and college groups, and I love teaching junior high especially. And I teach something called suicide statements. Okay, suicide statements, this is my favorite topic, and let me tell you what a suicide statement is. Suicide statement is a statement that kills itself, that is, it's self-refuting. Okay? For instance, if I say, this statement is a lie. Okay, that's a suicide statement, because immediately it self-refutes. Okay? Or I could say, I can't speak a word of English, said in English. Okay? Another one that's really popular is, I am the humblest man in the world. Okay? Suicide statement. You get that. Okay, great. Well, the first complaint that they gave is, this is a suicide statement. It's wrong to impose your moral values on others. Why is this a suicide statement? Because it's a moral value. The moral value that says it's wrong to impose your moral values on others is a moral value. So if somebody says it's wrong to impose your moral values on others, you say, why? Because it's wrong. You mean it's not right? Yeah, is that your moral value? I guess so. Then why are you imposing it on me? You know, the other one I always like is I say, you know, if somebody says there is no absolute truth, I'll say, is that absolutely true? Because if it is, there's at least one absolute truth. And if there is one, there might be more, right? Okay, so that's a suicide statement. It makes nothing. You see, the point is that it's okay to impose moral values on other people as long as they truly are moral values, right? The question is not whether we should impose moral values, but whose moral values should be imposed on other people. That's the real question that we're asking, right? It's a logical necessity. Okay, the next thing people say is you can't legislate morality. But let's just look at that for a second. In fact, there was a recent well-known senator, I won't mention his name, up and coming, they say he's going to run for president, that says, oh, I don't want to be in the business of legislating morality. Well, I want to say this is a very ignorant or stupid or disingenuous statement, because let's think about it. You can't legislate morality? This is pure nonsense. What else do we legislate? Immoral values? Platitudes? I mean, think about it. Think of one law that does not have something to do with a moral value. Killing is illegal. Oh, yeah, that's a moral value. Stealing is illegal. Oh, yeah, that's a moral value. Even something like speeding is illegal. Why is it illegal? Because they don't want you to speed, they want you to have fun, or what? Because it is what? Dangerous, which would kill somebody, which is a what? A moral value. All our laws are based on moral values. If anybody says your law, you can't legislate morality, they're either an idiot or they're lying to you. Vote means that you shouldn't be voting for them, by the way. The question is, whose moral values should we be legislating? Isn't it? Whose moral values should we be imposing on the general population? That's the question. Okay, so we do impose moral values and we do legislate it. Okay. Thirdly, most important point to be had here, because I think it's so key. Laws can't change hearts. This is pure nonsense. Truth is, laws change hearts all the time. Let me give you an example. As you know from my intro, I'm an Indian by birth. Well, after many years of refusing to do the Indian thing, which is have my parents select a beautiful, rich bride for me, like some rich doctor in India, go there, get married, get some big dowry, come back and live happily with lots of money, right? That was the Indian thing to do. My roommates all thought I was an idiot, especially when my mom sent these pictures of really cute girls, right? I just couldn't get myself to do it. I don't know why. I'm glad I didn't. Because after many years of doing this, I met a very young, gorgeous redhead. Yes, she is all that. Young, gorgeous, and a redhead. And I met her while on junior high outreach ministry. I know. Now, I know exactly what you're thinking. No, she wasn't in junior high. She was a counselor. But she was young. I'll give you that. And I know she was young because when I said, where have you been all my life? She said, grade school. So, but here's the point, unless you've been think I've been distracted by from my train of thought by my gorgeous wife. She's gorgeous, isn't she? She's a school teacher, that's why she had so many flower girls at already. First and second, third grade. Okay, but here's the point. See, her maternal grandfather, who died before I met her, was a very godly, wonderful man. He would have had trouble accepting me as a foreigner into her family. This is the reality, and she knows that, and her mom knows that, and we've talked about it. And it's a big joke, actually. It's like, yeah, your grandfather probably wouldn't have been happy with it. But he's a very godly man. See, the problem was, he grew up, many years ago, racism was the norm and in America, right? And young kids were born into a system that encouraged separation and racism, right? There was a difference between us and them. And kids grew up believing that racism was acceptable. But then the civil rights movement came in, and it was born by the religious people and the Christians, and the laws were changed. And interracial marriage was legalized in 1967. How many people knew that? In 1967, I was legally allowed to marry my wife, right? Now, this changed a lot of things, because this made kids who grew up under this law had a different concept of what was right and wrong. In fact, it was so prevalent that even families where the parents were racist, the kids still weren't. And I know this from practical example, because when I met my wife's parents, they lovingly accepted me with no hesitation. See the difference? See, laws do change hearts. They may not change your heart, but they will change your children's hearts and your children's children's hearts. Today, the good law says that homosexual marriage is immoral. If the law of the land changes, our own children, despite what we tell them that God says, will reject the moral laws of God and embrace and celebrate homosexuality. They will come to believe, and as we will see in Europe, they will assume that the meaning of marriage, that the institution of marriage is meaningless. They will ignore the fact that the law was given by God for our safety and our health. So we have to ask, who is going to make the laws of our land? Who's going to make the laws of this great nation? Are we going to sit by and let immoral concepts become the law of our land? Or are we going to let our children be brainwashed by new laws? Or are we going to draw the line in the sand and say, enough, enough. It has to stop somewhere. The decisions you make today will be borne by your children and their children. Who makes the rules and the laws in this country? Legislature, like elected officials. Right? Who enforces the rules in this country? The judges. If the elected officials and judges are not godly men, then what will happen to the rules and the laws of this country? What does the Bible say? The Bible says a wicked ruler is as dangerous to the poor as a lion or bear attacking them. What kind of men does the Bible say that should be governing? Exodus 18:21, moreover you shall select as rulers able men such as fear God, men of truth. But you say, but Neil, that's the Old Testament. That was only for the nation of Israel. Okay, fine. Let's go to the founders of the republic that we love. Charles Carroll, I'm just going to read a small part. Without morals, a republic cannot subsist any length of time. They therefore who are decrying the Christian religion are undermining the solid foundation of morals, the best security for the freedom, the duration of free governments. Noah Webster, let it be impressed on your mind that God commands you to choose for rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. There are lots more quotes. Hundreds of these quotes from our founding fathers. You see, here's the other thing. If we believe that Christians should not be involved in politics, then what we're saying is our founding fathers were violating God's rules by actually getting involved in founding a country, and that they should have been better served to stay home and preach the gospel. That's the natural, logical extension of that we should not be involved in politics, isn't it? So hear me ask you a question. Are you involved politically? Are you risking or sacrificing anything for a better tomorrow for your kids? Or are you just hoping that Jesus will come back soon? You know, the problem is any way you read Revelation, you know, I like what Greg Kuchel says. I don't understand Revelation. All I know is a lot of people get beat up and we win in the end. But the point is, any way you read it, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. Okay, so I don't think he's coming back tomorrow. Things are way too easy for us yet. No, don't give me that. Maybe we should make it worse so he comes back earlier. But here's the alarming thought. You see, the time is running out to stem the tide. Today, over 70% of the general public in the United States believe that gay marriage is wrong. But when you poll people under 30, a majority of them think it's okay. We're running out of time to change their minds and change the laws. A few years ago, California passed Proposition 22 that says marriage is between a man and a woman. Do you know that if we ran that same proposition today, we're afraid it would not pass? Just a few years later. That's how fast things are happening. We have to change it now. My wife is a school teacher, as I mentioned, and I was talking to one of her, you know, she's a public school teacher. So you know how liberal they get. I was talking to one of her fellow teachers the other day, and the teacher said this to me. She said, we decided we didn't want to force our moral values on our sons. We want them to choose their own values for themselves. And I said in my dry way, okay. I guess they'll have to get their moral values from MTV. And her eyes grew wide and her jaw dropped as she realized what she was saying. And she said, oh my. But wait a minute, isn't that exactly what we're saying about America? If we say we don't want to get involved in the laws and the moral values of America, then America should get its laws and moral values from MTV. Wait a minute. That's exactly what's happening. It's happening to us today, isn't it? We have filled every place amongst you. Cities, islands, fortresses, towns, marketplaces, art, theater, philosophy, universities, newspapers, magazines, TV shows, movies, popular music, the very camp, tribes, companies, governorships, senatorships, forums. We have left nothing to you but the evangelical Bible churches of your God. Is this the mocking letter that the world is sending to in Christians? We can turn the tide around. We must become the politicians. We must become the lawmakers. We must be the presidents and the Congress and the judges. We must be the civic leaders and the mayor and the school supervisors. And we must start from the bottom up. We must be the school board members. We must be the school supervisors. We must be the local county people. It starts at home. It starts here. Rabbi Daniel Lapin says that politics is no other than the application of your deeply held beliefs. And the anti-Christian forces are applying their deeply held beliefs. You see, their temples are putting out their pastors and preachers and lay ministers into universities, into school boards, into mayorships. Their temples are putting out their ministers and pastors and their senatorships and representatives and judges. They are voting with their religious beliefs. And they are getting involved in politics with their religious beliefs, are you? It's time to take a stand, because any battle you abandon, you lose by default. There's also practical reasons why we need to get involved, and I'm just going to go really quickly. Last year, a few years ago, a chief justice was removed from his position because he refused. He said that he believed that the Constitution forced him to acknowledge God. So they fired him as chief justice, even though he noted to them that the very day when they started that proceeding to fire him, they all took an oath that acknowledged God. Last year, an employee at a state university was fired because he didn't said he didn't want to receive emails promoting gay movies on his computer. This year, the Michigan Catholic Adoption Agency was forced to close down their adoption services because the state of Massachusetts said you have to allow gay couples to adopt. Our church, FCC, spent $1 million in legal fees just because we wanted to move to a larger campus. $1 million. That's not for the building. That's not for the reconstruction. That's not for the grounds. That's for legal fees. Our Ninth Circus recently said that parents have no rights as to what the children are being taught once they go to public school. That's what's going to happen. You took my thunder, Jack. How many of you have ever spanked your kids? Okay, 1 year in prison or $1,000 fine? Will it pass? May not now pass now, but in a few years it may. It's already illegal in Europe. In fact, it's illegal in Europe to homeschool your kids. It's coming here. So let me ask you a question. What's next? No more Bibles? If we don't stem the tide now, in a few years, America will be like Yemen. And I want you to seriously consider this. What will happen in a few years from now? Will I turn to my son or my daughter and say to her, Mary Catherine, I have to leave the country because I gave a Bible to a fellow worker, because it's illegal to give someone a Bible who is not a Christian in the United States. America's only 200 years old, folks. It could fall tomorrow. It's not going to be the same way forever unless we take a stand. So as I wrap up, I want to challenge you to do something. Will you take a stand? Will you take a stand? Because we can win this battle. And even if we fail, let us have the attitude of Esther. If I perish, I perish. But I will do it. I'm going to ask you for a commitment now. Will you commit today to get involved politically? Will you commit today that you will get involved in just causes? Whether it be knocking on doors, writing to the editor? Will you help a candidate or a woman? Would one of you decide to run for school board? Hopefully we have some school board members here. One of you decide to run for mayor or something. Just get involved. So what if you lose? You got to be in the running. You got to be out there. Give people a choice. Keep trying. Keep running. And do it intelligently. Do it rationally. You can't win in the United States by quoting the Bible, unfortunately. You've got to engage with them on a rational basis on their own issues. And that's what we need. We need men and women on board who are going to engage the lawmakers like Jesus did, who are going to be the lawmakers like Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. I want you to make that commitment today. Think about it and say, I am going to make that commitment. I'm going to get involved. Doesn't matter what level it is. If it's giving money, you can't just vote. Voting is not enough. And maybe in the answer question, I'll tell you why. Thank you.